Well, I loved your book. Absolutely loved
it.
Yes, yes.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
And I think the comparison to Elizabeth Gilbert is quite on target. In fact, before I had read that online, when I started reading it, I read the first couple of chapters and I thought, this reminds me of Gilbert. You've got that humor. You're just fun to read. It's just, yeah. So you didn't have that in mind at all, huh?
Oh, no, not at all. That's a compliment. I love that woman. She's a firecracker.
She is. All right. So when I was reading your bio, it says you're an author, you're an educator, lecturer, editor, proud parent, feminist, occasional ghostwriter, frequent ice cream eater. Mira, what's your favorite flavor?
Oh, easy. Chocolate peanut butter from Häagen-Dazs.
There really is a chocolate peanut butter, huh? I don't think I've ever had that.
The best. Chocolate ice cream with peanut butter chunks. And I've tried other brands. Mm-hmm. Of chocolate peanut butter, but the chocolate peanut butter from Häagen-Dazs is hands down the best. And we always have it in stock at our house.
It's rum raisin for me, but I'm going to give that a try.
Really? Yeah. You're one of the rum raisins.
Yeah. And that's not even very easy to find.
No. I've always wondered who buys the rum raisin.
It's
now
me.
I know.
All right.
Well, I know. We're keeping them busy.
Speaking of proud parent, Mira, I expect by the time this radio show airs, your little boy Theo is going to have a sibling. Is he excited?
He is so excited. For me, it's hard to wrap my head around the fact that there's a baby inside me that's mm-hmm. going to be coming out soon. So to explain it to my two-year-old is, I don't know if he gets it. I don't know if what he's thinking, but he's picking up on some things. He's told me that he's pregnant before. He told me he's going to nurse the baby. I asked him what kind of things he's going to be doing with his little sister.
Yeah.
And he told me he's going to play with her. And he said he's going to throw rocks at her. And he's going to throw her in the ocean. So I don't know what to expect. But I think he's going to be an amazing brother. He's such an affectionate little boy. So affectionate.
Well-loved people become loving people. So I think you're on the road there. Pour Your Soul, a memoir, is actually part of it, is about pregnancy and the loss. What is the book about?
Sure. The book in question, Pour Your Soul, is a short and muscular memoir it's about a lot of things. You could say the themes are survival and preservation, immigration, and one's relationship with grief and recovery, and the layover between youth and adulthood. But the central narrative of this story, a true story, is about child loss. In 2008, when I was 28 years old, I accidentally got pregnant while I was taking birth control pills. I never missed a day. Mm-hmm. And the pills were actually prescribed to me by my father. Since he's a doctor, he could just kind of quickly give me the prescription. Mm-hmm. He also was years and years and years ago in a Catholic seminary. So there was a little irony to the fact that I still got pregnant from taking birth control pills every single day, prescribed to me by a former Catholic seminarian who happened to be my dad.
Yeah.
And I was raised Catholic. So I was taking these pills and I had just started to date the man I'm now married to, Andrew. Mm-hmm. And we found out about 3 months into the pregnancy that I was, or into our relationship, that I was pregnant. And we were very much in love and we decided, you know, we're adults. Something led us to this place in life and we love each other very much. And we've only known each other for 3 months, but let's do this. And we decided to get engaged and have a baby and raise a family. And it was really challenging because up until that point, I considered myself more of a kind of a young adult rather than a parent.
Yeah.
And so all these different things were happening. I was in graduate school for writing, which is not a lucrative career. And I had huge student loans. And I was so worried about what my parents were going to think. And on and on and on. It was very stressful, but we went for it. And then in the fifth month of the pregnancy, I also had canceled my health insurance prior to meeting Andrew because I hadn't planned on getting pregnant. And I wanted to save money with my graduate school loans. And I didn't think I would actually need health insurance. So just to save a little bit more money and with my grad school class, I canceled. So I had no health insurance. So going to free clinics in New York City, and the treatment was not very great. It was a really stressful situation, but we kept going for it. But then in the fifth month of the pregnancy, during the ultrasound, that is that really exciting ultrasound that tells you the sex of your baby, we found out instead that the baby was inviable and wouldn't survive outside the womb.
Yeah.
So I had to, at that point, rather than being told, you know, the sex of the baby, we were told I had to make a decision, and I had 10 days to make a decision whether I wanted to continue with the pregnancy and inevitably miscarry or induce and deliver a baby that wouldn't survive or terminate the pregnancy. And I won't give it away, but yeah, that's kind of what everything hinged on at that point.
Pressure piled on top of pressure piled on top of pressure. I mean, wow.
And guilt upon guilt upon guilt.
So writing a memoir, and you also teach that, is got to be mm-hmm. one of the most challenging type of genres to write, I would think. You have to put yourself out there. You have to be extremely vulnerable. I think yep. most readers will immediately catch it if you're holding back or if you're trying to play the hero or whatever. People are yeah. very perceptive about that. But another challenge, I think, is memory. How did you approach writing this? How did you avoid, well, you can't avoid stepping on toes. I mean, even Andrew gets beaten up a little bit, although mostly, I've got to say, your husband sounds terrific. Just wonderful.
I know. I had an editor, it was my first agent, tell me, your husband sounds too much like a saint, so you have to kind of add a little dirt in there or just make him a little more believable. He really is a saint. So it was hard to do that part. But with your question of how to be more vulnerable or how to write a memoir?
Your challenges of writing a memoir. One of the things is, you know, being honest, but also memory. Memory is such a valuable thing. And, you know, when you talk to people about what do you remember in the same time, same place, you come up with entirely different memories.
Sure. Well, you know, the hardest chapter to write in this memoir was writing about the night my brother died.
Yeah.
Because I think something happened. Because of the trauma of it all, I couldn't, and I still can barely remember what it's like to be around him or what it was like when he was alive.
Yeah.
So when I wrote that chapter, all I could do was just, you know, write it almost like a bullet point list of what happened
mm-hmm.
because I don't have any emotion that I can easily tap into of what happened that night because everything happened so quickly.
Yeah.
So one thing I've learned in courses I've taken, writing courses I've taken, when you are writing something that is kind of like happening really quickly and exciting and just sort of go, 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 whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, you don't slow down and try to make it lyrical and show off your prose, because what's more important are the events that happen mm-hmm. rather than just the way you're telling it. You don't want your style to get in the way of the story. So luckily, that's a good moment where craft came in and sort of saved me and writing technique, because I don't know if it's possible for me to dig up how I was feeling when that happened, because I wasn't feeling anything. I was in shock. And especially with, there were a lot of scenes in the memoir where I don't know how I was feeling then, because I was just in shock. I didn't have time to process it. So I originally wrote this book in present tense because I wrote it immediately after it happened. It really only took me about
wow.
6 months to write the book, the get the bones down. And then I went back and
mm-hmm.
added more and more fat to it and backstory. But to get the action on the page was really easy. I just wrote what happened.
Mm.
And then I went back and polished up my prose, but the parts that are memories are mostly from my childhood, and I know that they're not there's no such thing as truth, one truth. It's just my truth and how I remember it, and then how I want to kind of repaint it in my brain.
Yeah.
But I know if my mom or my sister or my dad would retell the story, or even Andrew, it'd be a totally different perspective, a totally different book.
Exactly.
So I just had to be honest with myself and say, is this the memory that I feel the most comfortable with? And is this the one I want to kind of lock down? I could always write another book about the same thing and it'd be different. But I was really honest with myself and knew that I was writing this. Why did I write this book? I wrote this book to kind of heal. And I wasn't trying to impress anyone or make anyone feel sorry for me. I was just writing down what happened mm-hmm. and wanting people to be able to read it and feel less afraid and less weird and mm-hmm. and less on their own.
Yeah.
But I know memory's hard. I mean, I probably won't even remember what I did today.
Well, that's what I struggle with. I have no idea where I was yesterday. So, you know, that's one of the hard things. But something like losing your brother, I mean, that's so intense. But you did a wonderful job. The technique, like you said, you went back to craft in that. And you described yeah. action all around that event from different people's perspectives until it all just kind of closes in on that moment. And I thought that was
Thanks.
A brilliant
you remember
way
it
to...
Well.
Well, some things I do remember. but yeah, I thought you did a wonderful job
it.
With a very difficult scene to describe.
Thank you. I was going for, and this is where, you know, having writers teaching me with just really pure intentions where, like, this is a moment where you should just have, just be writing of cinematic angles, and this is a moment where you have to stop mm-hmm. and meditate and really marinate and get to the bottom of what your feelings are, and that wasn't the moment to do it. This was an action scene.
And you have an incredible amount of detail in there, so I was wondering about that, too. Did you keep a journal, and then was there something that you could check back on, you know, what you ate on a certain
oh, yeah.
day, or is that just kind of creative license?
Some of it's memory. Some of it is just deciding what kind of image or sensory detail can serve as a metaphor for something, mm-hmm. or to sort of put the reader in the mood. It's a lot of word choice. Another thing I did, I had, I go to Battle Creek all the time, and I'm still, my best friend Amanda still lives in Battle Creek, so, and she lives close to the place where Julian was killed, so a lot of the landmarks are still there. A lot of my memories are, you know, of just details are still really planted in there. And then some of it is creative license, just, you know, like, I don't know, maybe we were listening to a different song than the one I mentioned when we were driving home, but I know that's the music that I was listening to at the time, so it kind of sets that stage. And then I also relied on newspaper articles that I had found online just recently, as well as a lawyer. My publisher had a lawyer read the book and just go over everything and make sure I could fact-check everything and he could fact-check everything, and it was the most important things were accurate. Some of it's just kind of coloring in to paint a mood or set a mood that makes it more truthful rather than just, you know, a transcription of a security camera.
I wonder, too, that the other very large part of grief that you deal with in this book is the loss of an unborn child, of little Lily. And in one point towards the end of the book, you talk about this general silence among people when you've lost a child. You know, when you talked about somebody's friend who broke a bone in their foot, and she had her friends all come around her and fuss, and but nobody really talked to you about what happened to you. Was that part of the reason that you wanted to share your experience?
Yes. I was livid. And I still am livid about the way women are treated, particularly their sexuality and their reproductive choices, still are really taboo. And when they're talked about or they're written about, they're shelved in political sections of bookstores or feminist genres. It is everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, after I lost the baby, luckily I'm a memoirist and it worked for my personality because I'm an open book and I'm also a raw nerve, and it's just natural for me to be vulnerable. I just put myself out there. I don't know any other way, kind of how I was raised. I started talking about it after I kind of got over the shock, and women came out of the woodwork saying, you know, I had lost a baby, and I found out relatives of mine had miscarriages and never were discussed. And I was just shocked that they went through it without court. I mean, I felt like after I lost this baby, I just was thrown right back into the stream. And even just walking home a couple of days after being in the hospital in New York City, I mean, it was New York City, but, you know, someone would bump into me and say, get out of the way. Hey, I just lost a child. So that made me really livid, and that was my motivation for getting the book published.
Yeah.
Writing it, I just didn't know what else to do with myself and with my energy and emotions, but I'm still just shocked. And now even being pregnant, I'm still a little shocked the way it's not something that's treated as sacred or supported, and grief is really a private thing, and we don't, I guess I understand it's hard to understand how we cope with grief, but it just seems like this was a really taboo subject that people didn't want to talk about or participate in, and I really felt like I was on my own.
Mm. So what would you want your readers, the world, to understand when a woman goes through a miscarriage or for some reason a pregnancy doesn't end the way it should with a healthy, happy baby? What would you like people to do? What do you want people to learn from your book?
Oh, man. I think that I think the first thing would be to prioritize compassion. And it's really hard to know how to support someone other than, I mean, if it's someone you're close to, just be there for them and not be afraid to talk about it or to bring it up, even if it comes out really messy and manic, because it's something physically and emotionally, it's chaos, and it's not something that can be put in a box or made nice. It's just really messy, and that's just part of the grief. So I guess just not being afraid to talk about it and sort of paying attention, maybe educating oneself more about pregnancy and loss and what it's like. But I think one of the reasons I want people to read this book is just because it's one story, and it shows that even though it's a taboo topic, I think it's really important we don't generalize the stories and situations of women who choose or are forced to have an abortion. And I think this book will add a needed and meaningful dimension to understanding women's sexuality, because it's not just the woman. I mean, she doesn't get pregnant by herself.
Right.
So each person who makes a choice has a history of one thing that led to another thing that led to another thing that led to another thing. It wasn't just a careless choice. So I think talking about our stories and getting it out there at the dinner table is just fine. That's the way I was raised.
And there was a bit of a struggle for you to reconnect with Andrew, your husband.
Yeah.
He went through his grief very differently than you did.
Yeah. You know, this is just me. This is a flaw of mine, but it's still a little hard for me, and it might take some time. Maybe it would take less time if I weren't pregnant. But to slow down and notice that he was grieving too, and he is still grieving and processing, and he might have been traumatized too. He's part of this story too, and it's a good, you're giving me a good reminder to take good care of him as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just in it together, the two of us. We were far away from our families, so it was hard for me to comfort him, because often I wanted him to be comforting me, and we just,
right.
Really, we just needed to slow down. And that's why we left New York. We moved to Maine, because if we hadn't, our marriage would have fallen apart. We were so busy working and hustling, and once we moved here, our lives slowed down. We got pregnant about a month later. We're having our second kid soon, and we're happy and very much in love and still in love, and we still have some scars to explore, but we just put our marriage first.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we're still together, but I know he still has some things to go through.
Well, and you say some things in the book that I'm old enough to know that's true, that there's that saying that time heals all wounds. It doesn't. You just learn how to live with things, and you learn how to cope with things. And that was, I think,
yep.
One of the lessons that you learned from all of this grief and loss and pain.
You got to slow down. You really have to slow down and just take it easy.
And you have to give grief some respect, I think.
Yes. Yes. I know. There's no timing and there's no roadmap for it.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't hit me until maybe 3 months later, the shock of what had just happened. And at that point, those closest to us were kind of moving on. And I went back to school and I was totally baffled. It's like I had just woken up and had just been hit by a train.
Yeah.
I did not see that coming.
So now you're teaching memoir writing at the Maine Correctional Center to women. Tell me about that.
Yes. Oh, it is a gift. I'm taking a break right now. Once this baby comes out, I'm going to go back. So before I started teaching at the prison, I was teaching at a completely different kind of school called the SALT Institute for Documentary Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And SALT is a small kind of luxury school where students come in for 15 weeks and they choose a story or a subculture or something interesting to explore and produce a story about. And I love teaching there, but it was not as morally fulfilling as teaching at the prison is. These women, I've learned so much from them. They've had so much hardship in their life. I think something like 95% of incarcerated women are victims of domestic violence or sexual abuse. So to begin with, and I read somewhere that a lot of this begins around age 14. So they've had hardship their whole lives and not a life of luxury and choice. And they end up here just because of one action. They end up in the prison, and it's so easy to label them, just like, you know, someone could label me as a woman who had an abortion and hate me because of it. These women are in there because they were just trying to survive. So getting to know them and listening and letting them hear their stories and then giving them not only just the skills that I've been so fortunate to obtain through higher education, but the skills and also the respect and like love for them to feel safe to just share what happened and how they got there. And I've learned a lot about the penal system through them. I just finished an article for Elle Magazine about the shackling of incarcerated women during labor, which is still legal in many places. I didn't know that that existed until I started working at the prison, and just they've had it really bad. So I feel so fortunate to have the life that I have, and it just is a no-brainer that I'm going to spend time giving back and helping them. And it's so fulfilling. It's almost like I crave to do more for them because they're such incredibly strong women and great writers. And it's not even like we're writing. It's sort of like a therapy session at the same time, but their stories are mind-blowing. So I'm teaching there. It's at the Maine Correctional Center, and it's Maine's only women's prison. And I work with a group called Family Crisis Services, which is a domestic violence resource center in Maine. And the program I teach through is called the Incarcerated Women's Program. And I don't think I'll ever stop. It's the best job I've ever had. It's not even a job.
Good for you. And I hope at some point you've, if you haven't thought of it already, perhaps you will, putting an anthology of some kind together of these women's work.
Oh, yeah. We're working on it.
Oh, good.
We're working on it.
Come back to me and talk to me when you do.
Oh, I will. I definitely will.
How do you start? Tell me what that first class is like.
It's a little different because, like, when I was at SALT, the students are all staring at me, and they're so eager, and they kind of have a mindset of like, okay, we've paid for this program, give it to us.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started the program, I sit down, and the women sort of had their hackles up, and they're very protective,
sure.
And they're protective of their stories and of being vulnerable, because they have to be protective of themselves when they're in prison. I mean, they're already being judged.
Well, I would think that's the first challenge, is they've learned to put up walls, and writing a memoir is taking walls down, right?
Oh, yeah. It was hard. After we finished the program, I thought that they would be really willing to share their work with people, like outside of the class, but most of them vetoed putting together publicly shared anthology, which surprised me. But we're still working on it. So the first day, what I have them do is we read a letter. It's kind of a famous letter to Cheryl Strayed, who wrote the memoir Wild.
And
she used to be this advice columnist named Sugar, and people would write Dear Sugar letters. And there's a really famous one called, I can't say the whole title because it's a curse word, but it's Write Like a Mother. Beep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a young woman named Melissa Bassist wrote a letter to Cheryl saying, I can't write. I'm afraid. These are all the things I'm terrified about. I'm a writer who can't write.
Mm.
And then Cheryl in the letter responds back, basically saying, don't worry about it. Don't compare yourself to other people. Don't write like a girl. Don't write like a boy. Write like a mother bee. Mm-hmm. And it's really inspiring. And every time I read this essay or letter, I cry. And it just exposes and opens the door to vulnerability.
Yeah.
So I have the women read this letter out loud, and then or the women write a Dear Sugar letter to themselves that they'll read 15 weeks later and respond to. So they have to write a letter to their future self, writing about all the things they're afraid of and fear when they start writing. And then if they want to, it's optional. We go around the room and everyone shares their letter. So I'd say out of the 10 or 11 students I had, 10 or maybe 9 shared their letters. So it was just kind of like jumping into cold water, hitting the ground running. And from there, they could see that it's hard for everybody to share their story and really open up, but you just got to do it. So from there, I let them know this is a safe environment. Nothing leaves the room. We're in this together. We're a team. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of ripping off the Band-Aid immediately. And I think they could sense that I was on their side. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't going to judge them. And we kind of hit the ground running from there. But another really important thing that happened during the memoir class, which I learned from my therapist, actually, was, and I've learned this from other writers too, when you're writing about a traumatic event, you don't just hone in on the traumatic event. You really want to write about everything surrounding it.
Mm.
Like with my memoir, there's two narrative threads going on there, and the climax of both of them happen to be death, the death of the child and the death of Julian. But that is a really short blip on the radar of the whole story.
Yeah.
And you're not going to really understand the narrator unless you know all these really minor events in their life, because that gives you a picture of who they really are. So I would give the students prompts like write directions to your home, your childhood home from the interstate, and then rewrite those directions, but stop along the way at different landmarks where you have anecdotal stories that you remember from childhood. So there was a woman who was a convicted murderer, and all the different spots she had were spots where she really enjoyed looking at nature when she was a kid and exploring her backyard with her brothers. And you could get a sense of who she is besides just being a murderer. And another prompt I gave them was to write about the last time you wore a dress. A lot of them were pretty normal, but to one of the women, the last time she wore a dress, she was raped. And so you not only don't force them to write about the big trauma, but it just kind of comes out. Like, I think there were 6 women who were convicted murderers in the class, and I would never have said, write about your crime and why you're in jail.
Right,
because
right.
Bringing back my therapist, she said, you can't force someone to do that. They're going to need mental health consultant to be around them when they decide to get back to that memory. So I think the best thing that came from this class was that the women got to write and express themselves and also feel just as valuable and loved as anyone else on the outside. And I just saw somebody who works in the prison today, and the women were asking about me, and I really miss them, and I'm going to write them a letter and send them baby pictures. And I just found out I was pregnant right around the time I started teaching there, and they had kind of seen me grow and grow and grow. So I'll be back there.
Have they had an opportunity, or will they, to read Pour Your Soul?
Yes. Once the book comes out, I think I get something like 10 free copies, and they're all going to the prison.
And you're working on a second book already, also nonfiction, something about the history of spiritualism and clairvoyant women.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
This is a little more fun. This book, I had no idea it existed, and I was not planning on writing something like this. But a friend of mine who's a writer here in Maine, her name is Celia Johnson, and she's the founder of this really great magazine called Slice. And she's kind of my literary godmother. She connected me with the publisher who I have now, and she always finds great stories and tells me, I think you'd be interested in this one. So about a year ago, Celia was telling me that there's this really eccentric camp in northern Maine, spiritualists. And I had no idea what spiritualism was and what she was talking about. And I kind of put it off for a while. And then finally, I Googled it. And one of the first entries that came up was the Wikipedia definition or explanation of spiritualism, and it heavily centered around mediums and seances and psychic communication. And it sounds very hokey, but I went to the camp, and I also did a lot of research about spiritualism and how it started. And after I sort of looked past the kookiness of it all, I noticed that it was a lot about intuition without having, like, physical proof. And it was very much based on, it was very more popular with women than men. And when I went to visit the camp, there were only about 7 to 10 people living there, and it was all women, just one man. And they live there pretty much year-round, and they center their lives around essentially intuition and communicating with things they can't see. And it's hard for me to explain it because I'm still learning more about it, and I don't want to shortchange them because I don't yet understand it, and I don't consider myself a spiritualist, but I do have profound respect for intuition and a woman's intuition. I think that it's something that's not valued anymore, and that's kind of the theme that I'm going to be using as I explore the book and write the book. And then I'm also exploring the history of spiritualism, which is fascinating. But it's basically a book about spiritualism, the history of spiritualism, and women's intuition, and sort of like hunches versus technology. Mm-hmm. We seem to be getting all our truth and our facts from the news rather than exploring it ourselves. Mm. And what this camp is doing in Etna, Maine, these women are just trusting their own guts and living, changing their lives to sort of live in the woods and kind of separate themselves from society in some small ways just to live the life they feel like is the life they're meant to live. So I'm going to be spending a lot of time with them.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it's fun.